Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Mike Levins here. Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters here on 1180 WFYL, talking about the issues of the day, different topics you could call in. It's all about the Constitution because, you know what? It's been losing some importance in our society today, in our country. And it is the founding document. It is integral to everything that we do, and we have constitutional experts with us here on the program. Gary Porter, who is Executive Director of the Constitutional Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia. And Phil Duffy, who teaches on the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. We have both of them with us, as we do every week. Gentlemen, thank you so much again for being on the air this morning. It's wonderful to be with you guys.
Morning, Mike.
Morning. All right, well, we have an interesting topic for today, Gary. We've been talking about the founder's worldview for a while here. We're basically touching on different parts of the founder's worldview. And the founder's worldview is really important when you're talking about the Constitution, because you have to understand the guys who were writing it, where they were coming from. And we've been looking at their political views. Today, we're going to be looking at economics. And
yep. To give the listeners the background, we're walking through what's called the Peirce construct, P-E-E-R-S, and that is a way of looking at worldview developed by the Nehemiah Institute down in Orlando, Florida, and it stands for political, economic, educational, religious, and social. So I'm each week taking one of those subject areas and discussing how the founders viewed the world in that particular area. So yes, last week we talked about their political views. This week their economic views. Next week we'll talk about their educational views. The following week, their religious views, and we'll finish up by looking at their social views.
All right, so we're going to have a comprehensive look here at the founders and what they believed. And this is fascinating for me, because a lot of this, you guys are the experts here, a lot of this I was not privy to as far as the intricacies, as far as what exactly did the founders believe. And that's so important, Gary.
Well, we don't usually study the founders in any structured way. If we're interested in the founders' views, sometimes people will read the Federalist Papers and they'll think, okay, my job's done. But that doesn't really tell you much about them. And you really have to read some biographies. You have to read some essays that look at particular aspects of the founders. There's several good books that I've accessed in writing this series. There's one on What Would the Founders Say, and there's another one, What Would the Founders Do, and each of those takes a look at certain aspects of their lives and their views. Another book called Vindicating the Founders, Faith of the Founders. So when you start looking at it in a more disciplined way, a more exacting way, and you'll find out things about them that you never knew.
Well, let's go ahead and set the playing field. So when we're talking economics, people sometimes get intimidated by that, but we're talking really about four different fields. We've got capitalism as far as systems of economics. We've got socialism. We've got communism, and then we've got mixes of all the different, of maybe a little bit of both, or this or that, or take what you please. Phil, what's the, could you just clarify for our listeners, what specifically is the difference between socialism and communism?
Well, to begin with, socialism is a real system, and we've seen very dramatic examples of that. The USSR, for example, that's the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. They were called communists, but they're not communists. Communism is a state that it's a theoretical and a very ideal state that was identified probably by Marx and Engels first as being achievable, in which everybody gets what they need according to their means to contribute. However, the reality is that other than in small groups, the early Catholic Church was probably a pretty good example of that, communism is not a practical economic system for a nation state.
Now, that's interesting that you say that about communism, that it's more of an idyllic kind of form of government. And that it hasn't really, I mean, because the first thing you think of, like, you think the USSR is communism. But, yeah, that's interesting that you say that, though, about communism, that it's something of an ideal. What is it, like, never been achieved before?
Not as a nation state.
And that would be the difference between, I guess, communism and socialism, then.
Yes. And that is acknowledged by both Marx and Engels, I believe, in the manifesto of the Communist Party, which was published in 1848. So you're really down to two kinds of systems. We call it socialism today. It has some other labels, by the way, which I can get into. We call it socialism today, and then capitalism, as Gary has pointed out. However, the problem here is that you have a distinction between who runs things. It's not about who owns things. It's who runs things that matters here. For example, if we look at the way we're using the term socialism here as being really government planning of major elements of the economy, where did that first pop up? Well, if we go back in history, what we see is that it was the economic system employed by the pharaohs. It is probably the most ancient of economic systems. The alternative to that is a system that is run by, essentially, by the people. Now, there are always exceptions. For example, government tends to run things like war and defense. But on the other hand, you know, the major elements of a people-driven economic system is what the founding generation was attempting to achieve.
And if the founding generation was attempting to achieve peace and harmony, we'd have the idyllic sense of communism. It looks great on paper, right? Everyone gets an equal share and everyone's happy, but it never works that way because of men, you know, because of how men
human
are
nature.
What they do. Human nature. Now,
it actually doesn't come down to everyone getting an equal share. As Phil alluded to there, the famous quote from Marx is that to everyone according to his need, from everyone according to his ability. So you get what you need, not necessarily what is fair. There is a distinction. Now, people seem to think that communism is attractive because everyone's going to get the same stuff. Well, that's not what it says, really. And what they don't realize is that you're going to get what you need and not necessarily what you want in a communist system.
Yeah, like in Cuba, you get 2 pounds of rice and a chicken every month. They say that's what you need. I don't know if that's
what
you...
That's not what everybody gets, though. In Cuba, there are those that get a lot more than that.
Now that's interesting. See, I thought that was universal, specifically in Cuba, that they would only get, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's 5 pounds of rice. Maybe they're a little bit more generous than what I'm giving them, getting the credit for, 5 pounds of rice and a chicken. But people actually get a little bit more than that in Cuba.
I'm certain that if you belong to the Communist Party in Cuba, that you get a lot more than what other people get.
Ah, so you're saying if you're in power, you get a lot more than what the other people get, what the common people get.
Yeah,
that's
if I could make
works.
A point about this.
Now, some people who are enamored with the ideal of communism point to a couple places in Scripture, and they say, well, look, now the early Christians employed communism, and therefore we should too. And there's a couple places in Acts where they're talking about having everything in common and sharing their things, their goods, their food, their clothing, etc. And they say, well, because it worked there, then that proves that it can work on a national scale. But they don't make that logical jump to show that a small group of early first century Christians were sharing their goods, recognizing really that there's no such thing as private property, that God owns everything, and that as He commands, we should share what we have in excess with others. That's not to say that this system could be employed on a national scale. They think it can, but it really can't. It's simply unworkable, as Phil's pointed out.
Mike, can I make a point about this? I try to make a distinction between government-controlled economic systems and people-controlled economic systems. I mean, government-controlled, we need to think very, very deeply about the word government. In the final analysis, government is an abstraction, and behind that abstraction is the reality of individuals who have banded together to exert power over their fellow human beings. That is the reality of history. Okay. Now, I know that sounds harsh, but it is absolutely consistent. I mean, things have not changed.
No, that's true. That's true.
Now, to get a sense for that reality, what I would recommend is to read Milovan Gilis's book called The New Class. Now, who was Milovan Gilis? He was Tito's right-hand man in socialist Yugoslavia. And his book describes beautifully how socialism was used to give the benefits of the system to the governing class at the expense of the people. And so that's precisely what happened in Cuba. It also happened in the USSR. It happened universally.
Yeah, people don't plan for the evil of man, do they?
No, they don't seem to.
No, they don't seem to at all. I mean, I guess if you look at, because you know, early Christian recordings, you know, in Acts, what is now Scripture as well. You know, people point to that and go, oh yeah, it's communism, and. But there's a particular distinction, though, between how we know communism today and what that was. Like you said, everything they saw everything as belonging to God. You know, communism, at least in the, I guess, the conventional thought of it, is everyone, they think that everything belongs to man or to the government and that they're the be-all, end-all. I mean, that's why, you know, communist governments, they get rid of all religion. They get rid of Christianity in particular. That we know of communist nations where Christians are completely, utterly persecuted because of that, because the government wants to be everything. The government wants to be God, and it's just that ends up falling apart, and appropriately so. Adam, going back into the vein of economics, so let's stay on track here this morning on the vein of economics. I know we're digressing, but, you know, if you were asking Madison, which one of those systems would he have preferred? You know, maybe some people would think that, I don't know, the founders were socialist or communist. I mean, what would you say, Gary?
Well, as I point out in the essay, if you'd asked Madison whether he prefers communism or socialism or capitalism, he would have been entirely confused because those terms were not invented yet. They were not in vogue. So you'd have had to explain what you meant by them. Now, if you explain to Madison that what you meant by capitalism was a system where private ownership of property was respected and that individual citizens made the majority of economic decisions versus socialism, where the government's going to make the majority of economic decisions and private property is not, it may be allowed, but it's not certainly respected, then he certainly would have said, well, I'm a capitalist, because that's exactly, that comports with the way they operated, the way they structured the government they gave us in 1787. It was initially designed to be a essentially capitalist system where individuals had the right to property, the government had the primary duty of protecting that property, and the government made what minimal economic decisions were necessary, but only those, and certainly didn't try to control the economy as our current government does. So Madison is a capitalist, as all the founders were in that sense. Now, as I point out, there were some who took different views of where the limits to capitalism may lie. And for instance, Benjamin Franklin, I was intrigued to find out that he argued in a letter to Robert Morris that the property that we own in excess of our needs for basic survival, that there's some communal attachment to that, and there should be some ability for the community to redistribute that. I was surprised to find that at Franklin. Now, I would say that Franklin basically is a capitalist, if you look at how he conducted his life, but he had some views which certainly diverged from a true capitalistic view.
Well, also Alexander Hamilton would have actually been the opposite of you're talking a little bit about Madison, but Alexander Hamilton, where would he have stood if he knew what these terms were?
Phil, what do you think?
Well, I would call him a mercantilist, and hopefully we'll be able to get into where mercantilism fits on this scale. But I would say that he favored he certainly favored more involvement by the government in the economic system, and particularly I think it's his report of manufacturers starts what is called the American system, which I would counter is really the un-American system. But the basic idea is to provide subsidies for certain politically favored suppliers of goods and services.
Okay, so that's what a mercantilism would be, because I'm sitting there going, mercantilism, what exactly does that mean?
Well, maybe this is a good time to get to the economic system of the British Empire in the 18th century, which was mercantilism, by the way, and if you look at The Wealth of Nations, written by Adam Smith in 1776, the first part of that is a criticism of mercantilism. Also, if you look at Barbara Tuchman's The March of Folly, one of the books is How the British Lost America, and she really gets into the mercantilism and the corruption that it creates. But the economic system of the British Empire in the late 18th century has been called mercantilism. That's classic. Okay, now, so where does mercantilism fit into this scheme that we've been talking about? It certainly wasn't free market capitalism of Adam Smith, because he wouldn't have written the book to criticize it. So what were the characteristics of mercantilism? Now, according to the Library of Economics and Liberty, mercantilism has these attributes, and they're a long list, so please stay with me if you will, but you get a sense for the involvement of the government when you read these things. Restraint on imports and encouragement of exports, bringing gold and silver into the country, maintaining domestic employment, protection, if you will, of certain labor groups, granting a protection over certain merchants, for example, the Hudson's Bay Company. That's a, you know, a license that was given, a monopoly, if you will, that was given to that company, as was the British East India Company. Government provision of capital to otherwise private enterprise, exemption from guild rules and taxes, monopolies over local and colonial markets, granting of titles and pensions to successful producers, imposition of tariffs, quotas, and prohibitions on imports of goods that were competing with local manufacturers, and finally, prohibition of the export of tools and capital equipment and the immigration of skilled labor that would allow foreign countries and even the colonies of the home country to compete in the production of manufactured goods. Well, that's what was going on. In the colonies, one could not export, one could not sell a product directly to the Dutch or to the Spanish or to the Portuguese. You had to sell it to a British agent who then would resell it to these people. And, of course, if you shipped it, it had to be shipped on a British ship. It could not be shipped on an American ship or a Spanish ship. This is classic imperialism, if you will. So if anybody is confused about these attributes of an economic system and whether they fit more appropriately in the 18th or the 21st century, you'd have my understanding on that. We could easily describe our nation's current economic system as mercantilism, going all the way back to the British system that we fought against. So after 239 years, we seem to be right back at that point where the founding generation realized they had had enough of mercantilism, and they were willing to take on the world's strongest military force to establish a free enterprise system.
So that's where we're at today.
That's, in my opinion, where we're at.
In your opinion.
Time for another revolution.
Oh boy, you're gonna really stir up some conversation with that one there, Gary. Time for another revolution. There's some people who would say that. You know, the question, of course, is what's the best way to go about that? What kind of revolution? You know, violent one or something different, maybe.
When we come back from the break, maybe we can look at what would replace our current system, because many people forecast that this current system is just unsustainable. It is going to collapse, and then what rises in its ashes, it's anybody's guess. You know, will it be even a new constitution, or will it be will we try to resurrect what we had in 1787 and start over again? But, you know, when you look at $18 to $20 trillion in official debt, and really closer to $150 trillion in unofficial obligations, that the system is certainly not sustainable. It is going to crash. There's going to be a collapse. And what rises out of the ashes of that is anybody's guess right now.
Right. Well, the system, I think, is broken. I think, personally, I don't think the answer is necessarily a violent revolution necessarily. There may be some who are proponents of that, but I think it has more to do with our culture. I think it has more to do with where individuals are at, and I think that the one answer, and call me biased all day, I have no problem being biased for this, but I think the one answer is Christianity. I think it's Jesus. That's going to change people. But we'll go ahead and flesh that out a little bit more when we come back to the break, though. I kind of got the last word in there, but we'll hear from Gary and Phil as well. You could call in at 610-539-TALK for your opinion, your voice as well. You could be heard on this program, and we're going to head to a break. We'll see you on the other side of it, though. You're listening to 1180 WFYL, and this is We the People, the Constitution Matters.
The Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians 6:10 to be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might, so we can stand in the evil day. Let me ask you, are you standing strong in the Lord and in the power of His might? Hello, I'm Sam Rohr, president of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network and the American Pastors Network, agreeing with the Apostle Paul that when the days are evil, we need God's armor. To modern culture, right is wrong and wrong is right. Good is evil and evil is good. The war against God, the truth, and God's people was started by the devil and is in full swing. The Bible tells us that all who will live godly in Christ Jesus will be targeted and will suffer persecution in the spiritual war. So what must we do? Put on the whole armor of God. Imagine, God designed armor to help us in the spiritual battle and available to us. In the next few weeks, we'll look at this armor of God and what it's for and why we'd better put it on. I'm Sam Rohr, president of the American Pastors Network, asking you, did you put on God's armor today? Are you even in the battle?
Sign up as a partner at papastors.net.
Hey, Grandma, can you help me with my Common Core lesson on the Constitution? But the only part we're reading in 8th grade is the preamble and the First Amendment. I wonder when we'll get to study the rest of it. Didn't you say our founding fathers were wise patriots and wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect our freedom? This Common Core book we're reading says our founding fathers were racist and they didn't think women or blacks should ever be allowed to vote. She says, we the people. Didn't really mean you and me, but some rich white guys. That just makes me feel terrible about our country. We need to change things.
Oh, honey, that's not true at all. Our country is the greatest country the world has ever seen, and our founding fathers worked hard to be fair to everyone. I'm going to call our school board and our state board of education and ask why they allow Common Core and this book in your school.
Call your representatives now and ask them to stop Common Core and restore local control. Pennsylvanians Against Common Core brought you this message. Go to nopacommoncore.com or call 484-678-2236.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning and welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters here on 1180 WFYL. Mike Levins here, by the way. I don't even think I introduced myself in the beginning of the program. Welcome to listening, by the way. This is your weekly dose of the Constitution and how it matters in our society. You know how it matters, though. And we talk about the founders, the Constitution. We have constitutional experts Gary Porter and Phil Duffy with us. Gary, who is the executive director of the Constitution Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia, and we also have Phil Duffy, who's taught at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on the Constitution, both joining us on the phone. It's awesome to have you guys here for the program every week, whenever you can make it, but you guys are here a majority of the time, and we love having you guys, so thank you very much for being a part of this and for doing this.
My pleasure.
Our pleasure.
All righty, well, let's go ahead and we were at the break here, Phil. You were talking that you wanted to clarify. We've been talking about a lot of terms. Now, keep in mind that a lot of these are just that. They're terms as far as the Constitution is. Well, I'm sorry, not the Constitution. As far as, you know, mercantilism, socialism, communism, those are things that men have applied to different systems of doing things. So don't let the terms throw you if you're listening this morning and you haven't had your cup of coffee yet. Stick with us, okay? Phil's going to vet out one of them that we were just talking about, socialism. And we have ideas of what that is. But, Phil, you wanted to make some points. You're talking about the break on that, about socialism and what that is and different things you'd like to show.
Gary had shared a definition of socialism in his prior email, and he called it, according to the definition, an economic system in which the production and distribution of goods are controlled substantially by the government rather than by private enterprise. And here's the second part, and in which cooperation rather than competition guides economic activity. So first part is absolutely correct, and it reveals that socialism is that very old system. You know, it was the system of ancient Egypt. And we know from the Bible that the Egyptian system was reliant upon slave labor. Okay? So that fact calls into question the second part of the definition, which claims that socialism relies upon cooperation rather than competition. In the example of Egypt, and I think virtually every other situation, it certainly did not. And in fact, history demonstrates that when government controls the economy, another C word is more appropriate, which is coercion. That is the key. In contrast, it is capitalism or the free market economy, or whatever you wish to call it, that relies on both cooperation and competition simultaneously.
So you're saying that socialism, and just one point, you're saying a lot of things, but that actually started in Egypt. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And remember that the terms have changed over time. You couldn't go back to the pharaohs if you could resurrect them somehow and say, well, were you running socialism in Egypt? They'd be baffled by the term. But they probably
wouldn't know English either.
Yeah, probably. but they would acknowledge readily that the government ran the economy, the major parts of the economy. That's the point. It's government controlled versus people controlled.
This is really an ancient thing.
Oh, absolutely. I think if we were to go all the way back to recorded history, we'd find the same example. So the competition.
In my defense, however, I will point out that the definition I used in the essay, in which Phil took issue with the last clause, that came from dictionary.com online. So it's their definition of socialism. And as I read that, I said, these folks want to put a positive spin on the word socialism, and they've included that phrase about cooperation rather than competition, because I agree with Phil wholeheartedly that the way socialism is employed relies a lot more on coercion than cooperation.
Dictionary.com just got thrown under the bus by Gary.
Yeah.
You hear those da-doon.
Gary and I agree with each other on this. The competition part of the economic system guarantees that the suppliers of goods and services have to be ever vigilant in bringing the best value to the consumer. Now, there are two things that are happening simultaneously here, okay? There's no coercion in a free market transaction. For it to occur, both parties, the buyer and the seller, must mutually benefit or the transaction would not occur. And if that is not cooperation, then I don't know the meaning of the word.
Yeah, they've got to do it on their own free will.
Absolutely.
And that's why we have the free market economy. Go ahead.
And that's why the system was so appealing to Madison, Jefferson, Washington, Franklin and company.
Well, of course, because that's what they were advocating for. You could call in 610-539-TALK, the number to call, 610-539-TALK. So, Gary, we were talking a little bit before. This is an interesting topic that I'm sure is in the back of people's minds as we look at what's happening in the country, where maybe the system is broken beyond repair. Maybe the government is broken beyond repair. Maybe we need a revolution. That's what we were talking about beforehand.
We need a revolution in thinking, that's for sure. We have been lulled into this sense that what we have today is a free market capitalist society when it's everything but. The value of money is certainly not under the control of economics today. It is under the control of the government, who decides how much of it to print, and that determines then its relative value. So money and property and labor take on whole different meanings than their traditional terms when you allow the government to get involved in regulating those or controlling their distribution.
And you're saying we don't have a free market based on basically historical perspective, really, because a lot of people, you know, would say just that. We do have a free market, but from a historical perspective, it's not really as free as it should be.
No. In a free market, you would not have a minimum wage. A minimum wage would not exist in a free market, but the government has stepped in and decided there will be a minimum wage, and we're in fact in a dialogue whether to raise that minimum wage. But the existence of a minimum wage at all is not a free market concept. The minimum wage is zero. The true minimum wage is zero. That's the wage at which you don't have a job any longer. But companies should be free to set the wage at whatever your productivity provides for them.
Right, and that's a true free market.
Yeah, that's a true free market, which we do not have. When you have a government subsidizing strawberry farmers or pecan farmers or milk producers, you don't have a free market. You've got a very socialistic market where the government is making major economic decisions and redistributing money. We're taking money from one group of people and giving it to farmers, and we're taking money from another group of people and giving it to teachers. So we don't have a free market. We don't even have anything. Well, I won't say it doesn't in any way resemble capitalism, but the elements of capitalism that remain are very few and far between.
Well, Let's go ahead and compare, at least conventionally. I know we've been mixing around a lot of terms. And may I add, it seems like people can define whatever they want to be whatever they want today. Like, definitions are changing. Like, you guys even said you weren't so happy with the dictionary.com definition of socialism, you know, because you almost felt like they were trying to paint it more in a favorable view. Seems like people are just making things into whatever suits their needs today. That there is no true north, there is no standard of what things mean. But I just wanted to throw that out there. But I want to talk about one thing in particular, communism. Here's a popular view of what it's like as far as property. There is no property. The government owns all the property. Now contrast that with what the founders believed about property.
Well, absolutely, and that's one of their great truths is that they saw that everyone was entitled to property, and the government's primary reason for being was to secure property, to make it secure. John Dickinson said, "We cannot be free without being secure in our property. We cannot be secure in our property if, without our consent, others may, as by right, take it away." So if you're not secure in your property, if what you have acquired and put your labor into is not truly yours to do with as you please, then we don't live in a free society.
Now, I got two words. I got two words for you. Property, tax. What do you think?
There you go. So that brings in a whole different aspect of land ownership that we don't have time to go into, but it revolves around the whole idea that you don't own the land that you live on. You rent it from the government, and your property taxes are the proof of that. Just try not paying your property tax and see what happens to your land that you thought you owned.
Yeah. Phil, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question.
I've got to pay my rent to good old Uncle Sam, otherwise I'm going to get thrown off my property. I always have an issue with that one now, that especially since me and my fiance, we've been looking at different properties, and we're going to be doing an apartment for a little while to save some money, but we want to get a house eventually. And property taxes, you know, that could either make it or break it, depending on the property taxes in a certain area. I mean, even if you paid off your house, sometimes it's ridiculous. You know, where you'd have to pay, say you completely pay off your house, but you're paying $10,000, $15,000, even higher a year in just property taxes that if you don't pay, you're basically going to get evicted. So you're having to pay rent one way or another till the day that you die.
But property, though, is the true distinguishing characteristic that contrasts capitalism to communism. In capitalism, you do have the right to property. It is respected in most ways by government, and government is required to protect it. And the founders saw it that way. Life, liberty, and property is the way John Locke put it, and then Jefferson goes and changes that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But then the state government,
a little bit more general.
The state constitutions almost always put it back into the correct context: life, liberty, and property, and the ability to pursue happiness and safety. So the founders saw property as absolutely key to success of the system, private property, and that it was government's responsibility to keep it that way.
Phil, go ahead. You wanted to jump in there before, and
but the supporters of government controlling the economy are really very slippery on this. For example, the concept of economic fascism, that's a relatively modern term, and it's associated first with Mussolini and fascist Italy in the 1920s. It gets at property in a different way, and it raises the question about what is property. The Library of Economics and Liberty has a description of fascism as socialism with a capitalist veneer. And the site goes on to further describe fascism as where socialism sought totalitarian control of a society's economic processes through direct state operation of the means of production. Fascism sought that control indirectly through domination of nominally private owners, property here, if you will. Where socialism nationalized property explicitly, fascism did so implicitly by requiring owners to use their property in the national interest, that is, as the autocratic authority conceived it. Now, major parts of today's economy in the United States could also be described as fascist. Fascism is achieved through government law and regulation, which constrains owners to use their property in the national interest as conceived by the autocratic authority, that is, the government or the governing class. And so the original ownership, meaning of ownership and property, was that the owner had the right to acquire, modify, use, and dispose of property. The fascist says, I care not who holds a meaningless piece of paper as long as I control the property. So basically what's happening with the regulated society is that, you know, that's fascism being implemented because we're being told how we can use our property. We must use our property in the national interest.
610-539-TALK, the number to call, 610-539-TALK. So moving now from property, let's go into labor. Let's go and see how the founders looked at labor and what the connection was between property and labor. Gary, why don't you take that one?
Well, labor is inexorably mixed with property. Something becomes your property when you mix your labor with it. The classic example from Locke is that when you're walking across a field and you encounter an apple tree, when you pick an apple, you've added your labor to the article of the apple, and that apple then becomes your property. In a state of nature, that's how it would work. So labor and property are really closely aligned, and you produce your property by mixing your labor with something. And the founders saw that labor was honorable. It was just as the Bible describes it. It is an honorable pursuit. It also is necessary. Whatever you do, work heartily as unto the Lord and not unto men, says Colossians 3:23.
Yeah, I was going to say that too. That it was a good thing to work. It seems like today people are avoiding every way they can to work in any capacity.
Right, and that's not biblical. The Bible views work as not only a necessity, but also honorable before the Lord. and we are to work. If the founders saw this way, if a man will not work, he will not eat. And as we're going to find out when we look at how they treated the poor, they thought that was an important consideration. If the poor refused to work but were able to, they didn't get aid. They didn't get welfare. They were aided, if they were helped, only to the extent that they were unable to do so themselves.
Try campaigning on that today, Gary.
Yeah, well, that's not going to get you elected, that's for sure.
No, it's not. Also, you know, it's interesting because we always, I mean, we're talking about the Bible. I mean, the founders were inextricably linked to the Bible. It's just, that's just how it was for them.
Yes. When you start talking about the founders' worldview, it is very close to a biblical worldview. As we're going to see next week when we talk about their education, the Bible formed the basic thrust of their educational system, and so they learned of life through the lens of the Bible. And when I gave my hypothetical founder the Pew's test in preparing for the lecture I gave recently on this topic, my hypothetical founder scored very high up in biblical theism. Not a perfect score, but certainly well above norms. And so they saw the world through the lens of the Bible in almost every respect.
So you're telling me, the people, Mr. Gary Porter, you're telling me that the people who founded this nation were in many ways so identifiable with biblical worldviews that when we look at them, we just can't separate the two. Are you telling me the founders of our nation were probably in large part Christian and even put those Christian principles into our nation?
Well, the facts speak for themselves, and that's what I'm trying to demonstrate in this series of lectures, is that when you look at their writings, when you look at their actions, when you look at the design of government they give us, the way they approach social issues, religious issues, educational issues, it is all through the lens of the Bible. And you can't come off an investigation into their lives with any other conclusion, I don't think.
Are you telling me through the lens of history that, with the evidence that you've put forward, that our nation is a Christian nation?
Our nation was founded on Christian principles. Now, I have to be very careful, and you should as well, when you use the term Christian nation, because just like we saw with socialism, people have different definitions for different words. And when people say we're a Christian nation, you have to first ask them, what do you mean by that? Do you mean a nation where everyone acknowledges the God of the Bible? Well, clearly, we're not a Christian nation. That because we have only 78% of the general public that claims to be Christian, and the actions of that 78 maybe speak a different story. So you have to say, what do you mean by Christian nation? Do you mean a nation whose social foundations and governmental foundations and cultural foundations are built on Christianity? Absolutely, we are a Christian nation in that sense.
Yeah, and we are in every sense because of the Judeo-Christian heritage that followed our founders, that followed the culture, that followed the history that we see evident in documents like the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and letters that the founders wrote to everyone, even the letter that Jefferson wrote to Danbury Baptist, which has been used to define separation of church and state. And we've said on here before that's not what it has to do with at all. It has nothing to do with the church staying out of the government's business. It has everything to do with the government staying out of the church's business. And now we're seeing the opposite in today. Saying all that because it's important for people to know that everything that is said about the founders today, that they were not necessarily Christians, that they did not want, that's not exactly true. And that's not true that their principles and everything that they put into our nation, those things aren't Christian. And that in order for any nation to succeed, in order for any nation to be prosperous, I believe that you've got to be a large part a Christian nation, meaning culturally people are Christians.
Well, as we're going to see when we discuss their religious views, there were certainly some founders who wouldn't today be called fundamental Christians. They took different views, particularly later in their lives. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams particularly. Mm. But we're going to find out that they were raised on the Bible, they understood the importance of the Bible, and they had, many of them, if not most of them, a direct faith in God, and they expressed that numerous times in their writings. But as to our Christian nation, we're rapidly departing from the foundation that the founders gave us in terms of our structure and our philosophy of government and our culture. We're almost, you could say, fleeing from being a Christian nation in some sense, if you look at the way our culture is headed.
Right, and when I say Christian nation, I'm meaning a nation that was so influenced by Christianity in its government that it provided the freedoms and liberties. That Christian influence is what provided the freedoms and liberties, not some secular worldview. It's the Christian influence of our nation and the founders, in the history, in the people of when this nation was began, that actually gave us the freedoms and liberties that we hold dear and that we admire and cherish today, that are exemplified in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence specifically. So that's what I'm talking about when I mean a Christian nation, that it's because of our Christian heritage in many ways that we have the freedoms we have, not because of some secular idea, but because of Christian heritage alone. And that's what I put forward when I say that we're a Christian nation. You know, money is another thing, and we're wrapping up the program. We're not necessarily going to get to everything, but what about money? And that kind of encompasses a couple things here. You know, Phil, money, banking, you know, debt. We look at how our nation is being handled today, and what would the founders say?
Oh, they'd be appalled. The founding period was a period of emergency, if you will. If you look at the national debt, the private debt, things were in very bad shape. And, of course, during the period of the Revolution itself, there was a great deal of printing of money, and we hear even today, not worth a continental. Continental was paper money that was created to pay the troops and pay the vendors and so forth, and it took a whole wagon load of it to just get the very basics.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very concerned about creating what we would call today inflation by simply printing money.
Well, we could touch on that a little bit more next week, but we're going to continue looking at the founders' worldview here. The Constitution matters, we the people. Thank you so much for listening. This is Mike Levins, Gary Porter, and Phil Duffy saying we will see you next week on 1180 WFYL.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFYL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts.
Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot Road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.